Okay, today I'm in Ealing with Chris Dixon. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Chris. First of all, you seem to progress from being a part-time analyst on Coral TV to being suddenly in constant demand on racing TV and a formidable punting team with your brother, plus buying good horses. So in a few years, we need to know how that's happened.
Yeah, a lot's gone on. How did that all happen?
Well, can you start from the beginning? You're sort of a team. Did your interest in horse racing start together, or did you one of you G the other one up?
Martin and I both loved it from being pretty young, to be honest, Simon. I was probably about 10 when we first got taken to the races at Wetherby one day. Backed a horse that won coming from a long way back and just thought it was an absolutely massive thrill. And I remember the commentary that this horse was still in rear, and then he charged down the outside. I just thought it was fantastic and such an adrenaline buzz. And to that point, I'd largely been interested in football. That was the sport that I was interested in as a kid. At 5 years old, I wasn't watching the Derby or anything. We did, as most families did, have a bet on the Grand National. Dad used to go in and you'd back four or five each way, probably have some terrible bets and just enjoy watching that. But Martin and I used to then watch the racing on TV. It was, I suppose, part of grandstand it had been back then. I would have thought the BBC would have had certain races and you were watching the football scores coming in. It was all just one programme with sport, and that was where you consumed sport on TV, wasn't it? And so you were watching it, and when the racing came on, we used to either bet two peas sort of against each other and see who won at the end of the afternoon, or bits of chewing gum or whatever it might be that you had as the stake. You'd have a match, you'd pick one each, and that was how we sort of got watching it, and then really got into it when we were sort of, I would have been 10, Martin would have been 6, I would think, got into it then from going. And my dad was a farmer, and so he wouldn't leave the country for foreign holidays. My older brother and sister, sort of by the time we were that age, weren't coming on holiday with us anymore. So the trade-off was all our friends, they were going off abroad, and it sounded great. We weren't allowed to do that because Dad needed to be within a drive to get back home if anything went wrong on the farm. And the trade-off was we went somewhere that was racing. So I'd picked off loads of race courses, the pair of us, when we were quite young, and we just absolutely loved it.
That's quite unusual for somebody that young to get so into it. I suppose it was the racing and not the gambling in those days.
Yeah, it was, well, I say that, it was probably the gambling as well. We enjoyed the racing, but the point of it was, even against each other, trying to get the better of the other one during the course of an afternoon, and punting became more of it, because Dad didn't, he wasn't a big punter. He wasn't a punter at all. He didn't really like the idea of punting, and my granddad definitely didn't. And they would have been reasonably strict. My granddad definitely was, and so the gambling wasn't really encouraged, but once I was old enough to get away with putting my own bet on, then I encouraged it, and Martin didn't need a second invitation.
Right, so you mentioned earlier that your first love was football. Now, somewhere along the line, football attracted you again, because I understand you were an apprentice for Hull City.
Yeah, football was sort of the sport that I played. I was pretty good at it. I ended up getting an apprenticeship at Hull. I did that for 3 years, and I guess that was when I got more and more into the betting, because you'd finished training by, so you turned up to the ground maybe at 8:30, 9 o'clock, you got stuff ready, the pros would turn up at like 10:30, everyone trained, and then you were pretty much finished. It was pretty rare if you weren't finished by 1:30, 2 o'clock, really. There was the odd day where it wasn't. Wednesday was reserve games, so you wouldn't have Wednesday afternoon watching the racing, but because there was reserve games on a Wednesday, Tuesday was always a short day. Match on a Saturday for the youth team, so you were guaranteed to, on a Friday, be out early. We were supposed to go, well, we did go to college, but I happened to have a college teacher that liked the racing as well, and so we were still watching that to a degree and having a bet. So you kind of had a lot of spare time in your hands. My mates were doing their A-levels, and I used to get the train back from Hull to the little town that we lived in, sort of 30 minutes away from Hull, and I used to go into the bookies, into William Hill, and Martin knew which days I would be in there pretty much, and he used to conveniently miss the bus to school, turn up, and used to, the William Hill in Driffield, you used to walk in and the desk would be at the far corner, and the double doors that went in were on the same side as the desk, and there was those price finder machines, and it was like built into the wall, but it's kind of, as a result, jutted out a little bit from the wall. So Martin used to make sure he walked in through the right hand double door, slide up the back so that the view from the desk at the back was obscured and they couldn't see him for the prize finder machine. We'd stand there, watch the big screen on the opposite wall, and I give him the thumbs up when he had to get out because they were coming to tidy up the slips, and he used to scurry out, wait outside, and then come back in.
Now, did the punting put pay to your football career, or did it just not pan out?
No, I just wasn't quite good enough ultimately. I did 3 years and got released. I could have gone on and played probably conference or other non-league football, but I decided I wanted to go to university. Part of the apprenticeship scholarship, as it had become by then, was that you went to college for one full day and an afternoon during the course of a week. I'd done well enough there to apply for university. I got into university and I decided that I was going to go and do that rather than carry on playing football. I played non-league football while I was at university, but it was more a case. I just felt that I might have a career till I was 22, 23 if I was lucky, and then I'd be done with. And it just wasn't quite good enough to make it a fortune out of it. So
while you were at a seat of learning, did your punting get more academic as well?
Yeah, I mean, when I was playing football, you're on small wages as an apprentice. I was losing then. You kind of have to lose to learn to win, I suppose. And it was when I was at university that I started to think about wanting to win. I had more time on my hands, read a couple of books that I found sort of informative and inspirational at the same time. And eventually I started making it pay, but it was a fairly long process and quite a lot of hard work and torturous days where you kind of think, why the heck am I doing this? But it gave me a sort of determination to really want to win, focus my mind on trying to win.
And what were the books that inspired you so much?
Nick Mordin, Betting for a Living, was one of them. Read that one at university. And the main one had been a book called Picking Winners by Andy Beyer. And the opening chapter of that book was just, it kind of, when you read it as someone that was losing but wanting to win at the time, it kind of inspired you to think it can be done if I work hard enough, if I find something to go at, then it can be done. And he talked about the tough mental side of things and that most people are losing, but whatever you do, you're having a good time while you're doing it. So that was kind of the book that, I suppose, it probably changed the way that I thought about things and gave me even more determination to try and win.
So did you have any actual successful punting mentors, or was it all self-taught?
There was people that you'd look up to. I think the mentors that I got along the way probably came further on once I was already winning small amounts. But once I got a job at the Press Association after leaving university, there was a fellow there called Nigel Burns that was big into speed figures and things, and he showed me a few other books and things, and I was interested in what he had to say. We used to sit there and have a lot of chats about things. And then once I left the PA and I went to work for Coral as a broadcaster, through that I got to know Richard Hoyles pretty well. Graham Cunningham, Nick Luck, and they were kind of the people that set me on the Racing UK, now Racing TV path, I suppose. But they, particularly Hoylesy, I would have a lot of chats to him, and I guess people like that. Dave Nevison, when I interviewed him when I was at university, actually, and I was looking up to him at the time as someone that was making it pay, and he was buying and selling horses and things, and it seemed like a lot of fun. So there wasn't anyone in particular, but I think talking to anyone that's bang into it and maybe winning, maybe not, but just someone that you think's pretty good, they know a lot about it. You don't always agree with what people think, but you can learn a lot and take little bits from people about how you might do things and learn bits along the way. And I'd say there was a lot of people that I was like that with, but I probably learned more off Martin, my brother, than I did anyone. And he would probably say the same of me. We kind of threw ideas off each other and looked at things, and I would say he was probably the one most, and probably likewise the other way with me and him.
Now, I was talking to you before, and I got it wrong, that both of you work for Timeform, but yeah. Martin worked for Timeform.
Yeah, Martin worked for Timeform. I couldn't afford to work for Timeform. I left university, got a job at the Press Association. I'd had an interview for the BHA graduate scheme. One of the positions was at the Press Association. I'd already, through a link-up with non-league football, been going in during the summer break from universities to to the Press Association and doing some work, and I got a job there on leaving university, and I thought there's no point in going to the BHA interview. One of the placements is with them. I had it as my third choice or something, if I got through, and I thought I may as well just go and have a job. And it was sort of 40 minutes away from where mum and dad lived, so I could live somewhere for free, and I got a job. I then had an interview at Time Form and was offered a job, but my wife was doing a master's degree at York University, and we couldn't have both moved. We just couldn't afford, so we had to stay living with mum and dad, and I carried on working for the PA, and then eventually left and went and started broadcasting.
Right, now, interesting you mentioned those books, because I imagine that there's quite a few of those Nick Walden books on bookshelves for people watching this. A lot of people read those books, they're still not professional punters or successful punters even. So what separated you two after reading them? What made you more driven to become successful?
I suppose I got sick of losing money and I just felt that it could be done, and I started, like probably a lot of people, doing my own speed figures and things, which I don't do anymore, but I think the mechanics of knowing how they work was useful. Martin going to Time Form was a big thing, because he learned a lot there about race reading, and he learned an awful lot, and then we would be discussing it, and I learned through him on that front, I suppose. But I wouldn't say I'm a professional punter, because I do other work, but I do punt successfully, and I suppose it's a mindset thing, and it's a, I don't know how you go about winning particularly, but hard work is one of the things, and just trying to stay disciplined.
Now, how is it, it's strange that you both work together,
yeah.
You study form together, so that's, you're not identical twins or anything, so you're not telepathic. So how does that work? I mean, do you both think the same? Have you both learnt the same, and so you think the same?
We spend a lot of time on the phone chatting about things through races and whatever. We would have similar views on how you look at a race, what things are of interest. There's bits that interest me that don't interest him, and bits that interest him and don't interest me, but kind of all goes into the pot. The way a lot of it works is I think that nowadays there is so much racing on that you can't be on top of everything all of the time. So we would both watch almost all of the racing at some point, either be it live in the afternoon or replays later on. But at the start of the day, we would split up the cards. So if I happened to be working for Racing TV on Red Car, then Red Car would be the card that I would do. Martin would pick and choose his way around the rest, having gone through the cards, picked out races that might be of interest, and do more work on them. And likewise, if he's working and I'm not. So we kind of split up the cards and then come up with a strategy of where the views are on those cards and play it from there.
So there's never a time where you both excitedly reach for the phone and you've come up with exactly the same one, and it's a double star now.
Yeah, there is. There'll be the odd one where I suppose you're both looking at the big meetings, who would both be looking at. There is crossover on some meetings that we're both looking at, and you ring each other up, I really like this today, and the answer will be, yeah, it's a very good bet, isn't it? And I suppose sometimes you end up having too much on those ones because you're both absolutely bang behind it. But we've got an awful lot of trust in one another, and like there isn't really anyone that I would take a tip off as such and just back it because they said to back it, apart from Martin, because I know the process that has gone into it, and I know that he wouldn't just, and that's not to say someone else wouldn't have done a load of work to come up with it, but he's the one that if he says back something, I'll just back it, and I would say it'd be likewise the other way. But the rest of the time, I'd probably want to just go and have a look at what someone had said and make up my own mind.
Okay, so to finish this first part, like I said at the beginning, for the layman, you've come from almost nowhere. You've had like a meteoric rise. Did you have a couple of really big breaks, a couple of really good wins to set you on your way? Were you fortunate, or has it been a grind?
Yeah, I don't know if there's been a meteoric rise to anywhere. In terms of the work side of things, I got some lucky breaks through having got a job at Coral as a broadcaster that introduced me to people that were working within the media, and through doing sort of me interviewing them in a sense about races, they kind of cottoned on that I maybe had half an idea, and they suggested that I should try and do it. So I did a screen test and ended up doing the work. So I got some real good breaks from opportunities that were really provided by the likes of Nick Luck, Richard Hoyles and Graham Cunningham for me. From the punting point of view, it was a fairly steady grind of just winning a few quid each year, winning a bit more, and then sort of steadily increasing the stakes, being more comfortable with slightly bigger stakes year on year, and getting to a position where I can spend it on other things.
Okay, Chris, we talked in part one, you and your brother, two brains better than one, both good form students. What is it, still most people watching don't win? Or, yeah. You know, so what is it you guys see that others don't in form study?
I don't know. I think quite a lot of people have a thing, don't they? So they'll have their speed figures, time figures, whatever you want to call them, and there will be a disciple of those almost, or they're people like trainer angles, or people have different things that they latch onto. I don't think me and Mark really have one thing like that. I think we spend a lot of time looking at races and trying to pick out horses that are disadvantaged by something. I think we will cover races from a basic form point of view. So you'll go through and you'll notice that certain horses like certain ground, they like certain tracks, all that kind of thing that is just sort of run of the mill. You can basically read it out of the paper. I'd say probably where we get our edge is the more nuanced form study, where we would watch a lot of racing. And I think the great thing that punters have in this country is the variety of tracks. Racing fans say that the variety of track is what makes British and Irish racing really great, isn't it? That one day you're up and down hill somewhere, and another day you're on a dead flat track, and then another day you're turning left-handed downhill at Epsom, or whatever it might be. There's all these different things. And I think the great thing from a punter from that side of things is that because everything's so different, yes, form will work out in places, but it suits certain places suit some horses better than others. We will try and visualise races, I guess, into how they'll pan out. Pace analysis within a race, both afterwards and beforehand, is something that we would be looking at quite a bit. Knowing the horses, so, you know, knowing that you're kind of long striding plodder in a sense, probably isn't the right type for Catterick, but he might do all right at Redcar. And vice versa, the horse that has got loads of early speed and might just get away is your ideal type for Catterick, even if he could be a little bit of a short runner at times. So it's about watching the horses, knowing what they want, and kind of profiling a race and thinking, what is this race going to suit? What kind of horse is going to win this? And where is that horse within it? And then is that horse that it's going to suit well handicapped, in form, of interest, whatever it might be? Looking at things like, if a horse is out of form, why is it out of form? Is there a reason why it might bounce back to form? If it's in form, why is it in form? Is there a reason that it might not be in form? So you kind of, with the obvious horses, I think we would probably try and look for the negatives. With the horses that are immediately ruled out, you kind of, the obvious is that the negatives are obvious. That's why they're a biggish price. But can you see a positive in them? And I think it's probably that kind of thing, if that answers the question. I don't know whether it does or it doesn't, but we're looking at all sorts of things, but asking those kind of questions is probably where we come at it from, and occasionally find an edge. So I don't know, trainer form, loads of people spot the trainer that's in form. That's interesting, isn't it, that a trainer is having a load of winners. It's more interesting if he's just starting to have some winners, having been quiet for a couple of months because they've become well handicapped. And me and Martin Lofton discuss sort of trying to just be a little bit ahead of the curve with anything. I think once something is kind of proven or becomes popular opinion, the edge is kind of gone. So you're trying to just jump in a little bit sooner, whether that be an angle on a sire, an angle on a good claiming rider, a yard turning in form, a piece of form. Like when I say about horses being well handicapped, sorry, I'm rabbiting on here, but when I talk about a horse being well handicapped, something might be £5 below its last winning mark, which kind of is a flag that, yeah, it might be well handicapped on old form, but was it worth that rating that it went up to? It maybe beat a load of out of form horses by a long way and got whacked up the weights, and now it's dropped lower, but it might not be well handicapped. The horse that might be well handicapped is the one that has stayed on the same mark of 72 for its last six runs, but it's kept on bumping into a well handicapped one or two, and it's just been where it is, or it's dropped a few pound, and that kind of thing. So I think we spend quite a bit of time looking at the depth of a piece of form, and the depth behind a rating. We would both be using time form ratings and things, but the depth behind those ratings is probably something that we're interested in looking at and analysing.
So how many hours a day would be spent looking at a race and then deciding there's no bet?
Too many. But more so nowadays as well. Yeah, definitely more so nowadays. we spend a lot of time doing it. I mean, I say more so nowadays, we've both got young children, and that impacts a little bit what you can do, but we'll spend 3, 4, 5 hours a day thinking about it, looking at it, at least, I would say. By the time you've watched it all and things, it's a ridiculous amount of time that you sat there looking at it. In terms of actual focused form study, at least 2 or 3 hours on the cards that you're doing.
So what about tools that punters use? So I've got a list, so we can just go down through it and tell me if you think they're worthy or not. They've mentioned time form. I see you endorse pro form. Is that a bigger part of that?
I use that for keeping a few notes in, for picking up stats and things. I use it for mapping out the run of a race. So I use that on a regular basis. I keep little notes on trainer form and things like that. I'll keep a few horse notes in there. I keep individual performance notes in there a little bit. I use time form, as you say. I use their ratings and their time figures as much as anything else. I use the Racing Post for watching the videos. I keep a few ratings of our own in there. I use GG's a little bit. There's some handy little tools in there that flag things up quite nicely for you. They'd be the four main sort of ports of call there, and they're all really good. I just happen to use them all because, as I say, I think about lots of different things.
There's been a lot of talk about sectionals recently. If you had reliable sectionals, would that make you even more formidable?
Sectionals is an interesting one because they are interesting. The not the problem that I've got with them, but as soon as everyone's got something, then it kind of loses its value, doesn't it? I like the way that they're in time form at the minute. And they're really a nice way of using it, the finishing speed percentage things, and you can watch a race with that in mind. It's more informed than just watching it. There's something else to fall back on to back up what you may or may not have seen. I do think that they're interesting. I think it any extra information that you can get, that's great. But for someone who's reading a race in the way that we do and trying to pick things out, there is a chance that it actually stifles what you're trying to do, because everyone will know something went too quick rather than you just thinking something went too quick. Everyone will know that the hold up horse made good ground from too far back and it might get the more strongly run the rest of the day. So I think it's interesting. I think it can be good and welcome it coming along, but is it going to be the answer for punters? Probably not, because as I say, as soon as you give people information, more people have got it. It loses some of its value, or can lose its value anyway.
And you say you don't talk, you're not interested in information, you don't get the marks. A lot of the people I speak to rely a lot on marks, and they sort of go on that. They know it's definitely trying, that sort of thing. You know, it's fit and fancied, I should say.
With our own horses, bits and pieces of that will come along the way. But the problem that I have with information, again, is that in the vast majority of cases, if I've got it, so has everyone else. You know, I'm apart from with our own horses, and other people will still find out about those along the way. If I happen to have found out about it, that means that loads of other people have found out about it. Now, if you can get on the night before, great. You know early that is working well and it's fancied and it's trying for its life and this and that. But if you can't, by the time you're betting 10 minutes before the race, that is largely, I would think, factored in. And it's one of the reasons that wouldn't really bet that much in novice and maiden races. I'll have a few bets in them, but I think if you think about the betting market and the price being a response to the information that is in there, I think if you're betting into a maiden or a novice, you're betting into a market which, if you don't know anything in terms of inside information, there are people that have got more important information than you betting into that, factoring the price. Whereas on a handicap with a reasonable size field, I would be backing ourselves to have a view that we can make that pay, that the information isn't quite as important. It's more about what you think and what you see from the form book.
So I know it's how long's a piece of string, but how many bets a day would you have on average?
Less nowadays than we used to have. It depends. On a weekend it'll be more. During the week, early part of the week, it might be one or two. It can be 8 or 9. It's less so as many as that nowadays. We'll occasionally try and get out into the shops and get a few bets on maybe. A lot of it is through exchanges, and we'll be working away with that. But yeah, on average, probably 3 or 4 a day max nowadays. But apart from on a Saturday, you'll have more.
Okay, now you mentioned getting on. How do you get on? Because I'm sure that most bookmakers aren't really over enamoured when you try opening an account with them.
No, I've given up on trying to get other people's accounts. I'll occasionally get mates to get bets on. Just a one-off, send them the money, they get it on, and if it wins, you get it sent back. I'll do a bit of that. But most of the time, we're just betting on the exchanges through our exchange accounts. And as I say, a bit in shops with cash and things like that. But most of it would probably nowadays, didn't used to, but most of it go through the exchanges. And as I say, you get along the way, if you think something's sort of definitely not going to last and you just want a bit of something on, then occasionally try a few mates.
Okay, now you're successful punters, but even the most successful punters suffer the inevitable bad losing run. How do you mentally cope with those?
By having a job, I suppose, and knowing that it's not the be all and end all, that the punting money is something different, and it still absolutely fries your head, doesn't it? You're not doing anything different, but you kind of end up doing something different, and I think you find yourself levitating to the shorter prices because you just want to have a winner, and it probably isn't the way to go. They're horrible, but I suppose you deal with them. It helps. I think it helps that there's two of us, because there's obviously if you're both going through a bit of a bad spell, it can be a bit savage, but I think that helps. But at this stage now, it's kind of a knowledge that it does eventually turn, because it's happened so many times. Sometimes you need a couple of days off to just freshen up, take your mind out of it and think, right, I'm going back now. But yeah, they're horrible, aren't they?
Do you get involved with laying at all?
Not really, not very good at it. Tried a few times. I'd rather just back something against it. I think when you're laying something, you're having horses on side that you still don't really like, and I'd rather just back three in the race that I do like rather than lay something.
And Muggy, change your life motor pools?
Yeah, I don't know whether they're Muggy necessarily. It's a shame BSP multiples have gone. We've had a few good results out of that kind of thing. And the thinking being that if you're having four good bets, you're just rolling up the value in them, aren't you? And if you can be bothered to go out into the shops and in where there's competitive areas of shops and they're laying treble the odds on a one winner in a lucky 15 and things, they're giving you a chance of it not going too bad. So yeah, we do play them, probably less so at the moment than we used to, and that's just because of the BSP thing. But you just do it to a smaller stake, but if they all come in, then you're onto a nice result. So it's definitely something that I wouldn't rule out.
So a lot of people might be surprised by that. So when we go out and have our Yankees and Lucky 15s, we've not been totally Muggy after all. And what is the biggest mistake that most punters make that lose?
Biggest mistake? Probably concentrating solely on the Yankees and the Lucky 15s, because the day-to-day best bets that you'll have will be those win singles, I think. Well, the best bets that are the ones that you can't get on, like an each-way double and things that any bookmaker, as soon as you start doing those, probably isn't interested. I think probably not doing enough work, but that's just a time thing, isn't it? Let's be honest, for most people it is a fun thing, and if you spend a few quid on something that is fun, not everyone takes it as seriously. I think probably chasing and trying to get everything back. There's always, you know, there's going to be races in 2 months' time if you need that long off. Probably chasing is the biggest mistake that people make, and also just being suckered into the obvious a little bit too often, I would say. I often think if you're, I obviously work in the press media kind of thing, if everyone agrees, then there probably isn't much there in the price, is there? So a lot of our betting would come in the mid to good end handicaps. There'll be some bets in lower grade handicaps as well. Mentioned already that novice and maiden races, I think you're betting against the information maybe a little bit too much. They've got the edge on you. Say in group races and the races that are scrutinised in the press and everyone's talking about and everyone does the relevant work on those races, then unless you're thinking different to what everyone else is thinking, then you probably don't want to be having the bet. I think that in the day-to-day racing, there isn't the same level of scrutiny goes into it. So I think going with the obvious is probably the mistake that most people make, because if it's obvious, then there's probably not too much value in the price. The bookmakers aren't daft.
Okay, just carrying on a bit about the punting, what's the difference between a knowledgeable punter and a winning punter?
The winning one has some money left. I don't know. I suppose it's the winning punter knows the difference between, they can factor in the price. They know when they're having a good bet rather than it just being a good horse. You know, that there are plenty of people that can spot a nice horse, they can read the form, but probably better than I can, but they might not be able to bring that back to whether something is the right price, the wrong price, too short a price, whatever it might be. So I think it's that. I think it's having a take on prices and probably a discipline as well, a discipline as to whether or not you should have a bet or not. And everyone has rough patches on that front, don't they? But I think it's probably that final bit of decision making. Once you've done the race, you've looked at the form, you've decided what you think, it's then deciding whether what you think is a good bet or not.
So moving onwards, not content with mastering the form book in the bookmakers, you're now buying and selling horses successfully. Where did the knowledge from that come from? I mean, do you know the stud book as well as the form book these days?
Well, most of the horses that we buy, I mean, the pedigree analysis is something that's a big part of our punting as well. I think a lot of horses would conform to their pedigree to some degree. I think we take a punter's mentality towards the buying and selling of horses, and it's probably, we wanted to do it because we thought we could, you know, and being involved in owning horses has been massive fun. I absolutely love it. But we probably we've gone into it something a little bit different to what most people that are looking at, that are buying horses, so your agents and things are going in, they'll be on top of the form, this and that, but a lot of them are buying for someone else. You've got to be able to put that across to someone else. We probably take a few more risks than we buy horses that other people maybe wouldn't want to buy. That's something that we've perhaps done. And we're looking, all we see it as really is another bet, and it's just one that takes longer to come out. And along the way, you might have a normal bet on that horse winning if things line up right. But it's just another way of putting the same work that we've already done on form analysis and pedigrees and all of that, and watching. Our main ownership group is the Horse Watchers, four of us, and it's called that because that's what we do. We watch horses a lot, and you're looking at things and you're finding angles on horses, and they pop up in a sales catalogue and you think, that's well handicapped. If that lined up under this set of conditions, I would want to back it. And I suppose it's, maybe that's how we've done it.
Okay, you say it's a much bigger bet. I mean, we haven't talked about the sort of figures you bet in, but surely this is a much bigger bet.
Yeah, it is a much bigger bet, although you get more than one bite of the cherry, I guess. It's not just done and dusted in the space of a minute or 2 minutes or whatever, however long the race is that you've had a bet on. It's not all about one day, is it? And it's a longer term investment, I suppose. And look, you're not going to make money on every horse that you buy in campaign. We try and not keep them for too long. Keeping a horse in this country for a long period of time is quite difficult because the prize money situation isn't conducive to being able to make it pay on that front because of your training fees and things. So we try and buy them well handicapped, campaign them, and then move them on at the time that's right. Probably a bit of a idea that we're not going to sell something on if we think there's a lot left in there, but probably do. You have to let horses go and there's still something left, because otherwise people are never going to buy them off you in the future. A lot of the horses that once we finish with them, they normally go abroad, and we're sort of conscious of that being the case, that a lot of the horses that we've had will eventually get sold abroad rather than over here. Probably because of that view, people have definitely said to me that, why would we want to buy off you lot when you've had your time with it, because you've probably had your bets and done this and that and whatever. But I don't actually think that's true. we've sold some nice horses early on as well, but it's kind of become more of a thing that we have to move horses on to be able to buy new ones, because we're not just going to throw money at it. It kind of has to pay for itself along the way.
So your knowledge in that all came from your knowledge of the form book initially?
Basically, and then we obviously Mick Appleby trains most of the horses for us, and we've lent on his knowledge. You know, we can kind of go and look at a horse and see a nice horse from a not very nice one of things, but his knowledge on the soundness of it and things like that, and whether it will stand up to the training that he wants to put them through and all that kind of thing. And we use a vet to check horses out at the sales as well, but we're relying on someone else from that side of things. But yeah, the work that goes into pinpointing the horses that we're going to buy is basically the same work as what you would do from a punting point of view.
Now, when I was Googling you guys, I came up with this, I found the slogan or the saying, buy well, campaign well, punt well. I suppose if you can do that, that's a fairly a good business plan.
Yeah, I don't know who came up with that. It's quite good though. It probably wasn't me. My dad, as I said, he was a farmer, and he was a stockman really, and he loved buying and selling things, and there was nothing. He was sort of known among the farming community where we were from that my dad was always by the bullocks that no one else wanted. He'd buy the ones that looked poor, and then he'd bring them back 6 months down the line, and they suddenly looked a lot better than they used to. Or he had an eye for what was there. And Dad used to always say to me and Martin, "You make your profit the day you buy it." And buying well is definitely something you've got to do. You're similar to punting in a sense. When you're buying the horse, you've got to put your price on it and think, that's where I value it. And part of that price is based on where you think you're going with it in the future, I guess. So that's buying well is definitely important. Campaigning well is just standard, isn't it? You've got to put horses in the right races where you think they've got a good chance of winning. We try and plan horses' campaigns out as best we can, and put them in the right set of circumstances as often as we can. And if that lines up to being a good bet along the way, then absolutely brilliant. And yeah, there have been some good bets along the way since we started owning them.
So you play the long game. You look in like a game of chess. You're looking 3 or 4 moves ahead when you campaign these horses?
Sometimes, but a lot of the time, when we buy them, we've kind of got an idea of what we think we might want to do with it. Now, it can go completely downhill. You can change your plan completely. One of the first horses that we had, Pearl Nation, he didn't run under the Horse Watchers name, but it was the people basically that are involved in the Horse Watchers largely that own Pearl Nation. And once we bought him, I went up to Mick and I said, right, there's a Air Gold Cup winner, Mick. He's rated 70 something. He's a 9500 horse. He wants dropping to 6 furlongs and whatever. Anyway, Mick started working. He says, you're right, he's a 95 to 100 horse, but he's not an Air Gold Cup horse. He wants further. He's 7 furlongs or a mile, really, which I would have argued at the time, well, plenty of 7 furlong horses win the Air Gold Cup. But he turned out being a 7 furlong miler, and he did end up being a bit of a, he wasn't a Southall, well, he was a Southall specialist. He was better at Southall than anywhere else, but he won on the turf. He won on, was it Polytrack back then, I think, at Wolverhampton still. Anyway, he won at Wolverhampton, so he was effective on those tracks, but he was a better horse at Southall. But he was a 7 furlong horse, and we had a good bet on him, admittedly at a shortish price, the day that he won at Yarmouth, first run for us. And that kind of factor of, you were right but you were wrong, you've kind of got to accept, and we trust Mick's view on what he's telling us about how they're working and things, and try and go and watch work as well to form our own views on it.
They've mentioned Mick a few times. This is Mick Appleby, of course. Why did you choose Mick in the first place?
Very good trainer at turning horses around and getting the best out of whatever he had. So if you felt that a horse could get to a certain level, it would probably get there if Mick trained it. And that was the view that we took. He had a brilliant record. The first horse that we had was in a partnership called Rodding Pickle Partnership. It was a cheap horse. Richard Hoyles was involved in that partnership at the start. And I was chatting to Richard regularly about the racing at that point, and we'd narrowed down to a few different trainers, and we were both probably at that point trainer switches that everyone talks about. He's moved to so and so now. That wasn't as big a part, that the prices would last a little bit longer, but it was quite apparent even then, very early on with Mick training for sort of the second time, that he was just getting hold of horses from other people and they would win straight away. And there was a horse that had been up in Scotland in a bumper it had run like a year and a half earlier, and it had shown nothing. And it won at a massive price in a Utoxeter bumper. John Hunt commentated on the race, and I remember it wasn't really going anywhere, and it ran on and won. And I rang Hoylesy when I was driving home that night. I'd been working at Coral that afternoon, and I said, did you see that? We chatted about it in the morning. I said, did you watch that? And he says, yeah, I did. Great result kind of thing. I think it had won at 40 to 1 from 50s, as I say. And I just said to him, well, that's our man to train the horse then, isn't it? And Hoylesy just said to me, right, well, give him a ring then. Because Hoylesy had had horses before, so he knew how everything worked, sort of the ownership side of things, setting it all up. So he dealt with that. I dealt with contacting Mick, and he kind of showed me the way with how to get involved with horses. And we just ended up getting the bug in a big, big way.
Now, so you've got the Horse Watchers, Rod in a Pickle and Slipstream, all something you were involved with. How important is syndication, do you think, to you, and how big it should it be compared to what it is now?
I think it's massive, and it's something that I'm quite keen to sort of, promote the benefits of. I think, obviously, owning horses is expensive. It's less expensive if you split it a few ways, and actually it can increase the enjoyment. Part of the enjoyment of us having the horses is our group chat, where there's the four of us and Mick mapping things out for the horses, discussing how they're going, discussing what we're going to try and buy. That shared enjoyment of how you think a race is going to pan out. Is it a good bet? What do you make of the opposition when you're running against them? And throwing all of that into the pot and having that social side of things without it being necessarily a day out, but that interaction with one another where you're all on a common cause. And I think that's something that's really great about owning horses in a group. And the way that prize money is in this country, it's not, there aren't that many people that can afford to buy a horse, have it trained, and take up the losses that come along with having a horse in training when the prize money isn't that great and if it doesn't do that well. But if you split that a few ways, then it becomes affordable, doesn't it? It's just another leisure activity, in a sense, admittedly still quite an expensive one, depending on what level of share you have. We tried to set up a Horse Watchers syndicate with other people in last year, because the Horse Watchers is basically four of us. Rod in Pickle is similar with the odd extra person in, but the percentage share is a bit different. Slipstream Racing is a different thing that's based at Mix Yard, and it's three horses for the winter among 10 people that were current owners at Mix. We tried to set something up with the Horse Watchers where we sold some shares, and it went disastrously wrong. We bought a horse that we thought was well handicapped, thought he'd do a really good job. We got half of him sold, we still had half left, and he picked up a minor setback, really, and so we stopped selling shares. We were left holding half of him, and then that horse, the minor setback became something a bit more significant. He needed his knee operating on, so he had that done. We spent the money getting the knee operation done. And when he was on box rest coming back, he basically flipped over in his box, broke his pelvis, and it was irreparable, and he had to be put down. And it put me off in the short term managing another syndicate. That was only last year, and I just felt terrible. You kind of ring people up and it's the first time that they've been involved with you. They've seen that you've had good success in the past, and they've come in on exactly the wrong one. And we did feel really, really bad about it, and still do. In the short term, that's put me off running syndicates ourselves, but I think it's something we will revisit and try and do again and hopefully get it right. I am quite keen to try and get people into it and provide an avenue to see how much fun it is. I think it's something that more people that are racing fans should have a go at and accept that they can actually afford it. And there are already great syndicates out there, aren't there? There's loads and that are doing really well, so hopefully people keep on joining up to those. If we decide to throw something into the mix along the way, then hopefully we'll attract a few people as well.
Okay, now to conclude, really, we've talked, you're successful with everything you've done, pretty much.
Well, I failed at football.
Well, but you still, you're in Ealing now, you're coming down to do a shift at Racing TV. I mean, why do you bother with that?
I enjoy it, for one. I really enjoy it. I enjoy working. And people will often say to me, like, if you're winning money betting, why are you working still? What's the point? One is that I'm not winning enough betting to just do nothing else. I probably could, but I want to do other things. I probably could have a well, I could have a wage from it, but I've got a young family that I want him, I want my little boy to sort of have plenty along the way. And working doesn't bother me. My wife doesn't work. She's extremely supportive of what I do, and she lets me put all the time into it, and it works better for the work that I do. All dovetails in with the punting, so the buying and the selling of the horses, the campaigning of them, the TV work that I do. I still do some previews for Coral Bookmakers on a Monday. I normally go in there, and so I'm doing those things, and I really enjoy it. When I go into Coral, it's mates that I've had for 10, 15 years that are running it. So I go in there and I see them. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't see them. I wouldn't socialise with them because I live a fair way off. The TV side of things, I enjoy working with people. I think you learn a lot talking to people, listening to what they do, and how they think. And it takes the pressure off having to win. You know, if I don't want to have a bet for 2 weeks because I'm too busy with other things, I don't have to. If I don't feel like sitting in the office and betting that day, I don't actually have to, because I've got an income from a job. And it takes away the pressure of having to win betting. And I don't know whether or not I would win with that pressure of having to win. It becomes a different beast, I think, at that point, where you don't have another stream of income. I think Dave Neveson said to me years and years and years ago, scared money never wins. And I reckon that if you go on a losing run that everyone goes on, and the mortgage is to pay and the bills are to pay and whatever, it becomes a bit harder at that point to keep on throwing the bank at it, doesn't it, to make sure they're paid. Whereas if you do something else to pay them, then that's just on the side. And for me it makes it more enjoyable. And as I say, I'm not sure that I would win without working because of the different mental pressure it would put on me.
Okay, then finally, you've got horses in training. You've been in training yourself. The Great North Run, have you trained on?
I've done a couple of runs since, yeah. I didn't really stay in the Great North Run, but my training had probably been over a little bit too short. I flew first 10 miles and then I was struggling a little bit at the end, but no, I will train on. I've got no plans on stepping up in Trip, and I'll probably be dropping back in Trip.
Brilliant. Well, Chris Dixon, thank you very much.
Cheers, Simon.